From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what's happening with EV sales now that gas prices are soaring?
Without that tax credit, all of a sudden that EV essentially became $7,500 more expensive.
Also, a researcher at MSU talks about the breakthrough in magnetic technology that may allow surgery to be performed at microscopic levels.
They're made by a compatible polymer or biodegradable polymer and also nanoparticles, which can degrade themselves or can be removed by our circulation system, which is pretty safe.
And our podcast On Hand answers a listener's question. How did Michigan come to be a state of not one, but two Pleasant Peninsulas?
President Andrew Jackson and the U.S. Congress have had enough. They step in to resolve this thing with the area of dispute, now often called the Toledo Strip.
Those stories coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, ever wonder how Michigan came to have an Upper Peninsula?
They kind of swallow the bitter pill and they endorse the compromise.
For our latest episode of On Hand, we're getting a little help from the Interlochen Public Radio crew. That's later on. But first, if you drive a vehicle, you know by now that gas prices have gone up significantly over the past few weeks, in large part because of the U.S. and Israeli war with Iran and Iran's control over the Strait of Hormuz, a pinch point in global oil shipping. Perhaps related to that gas price story, electric vehicle sales have gone up in the past month, and Tesla specifically is seeing renewed interest in its fleet. Lindsay Van Hulley is a deputy editor who covers EVs at Automotive News, and she's been watching this story as it unfolds. Lindsay, welcome back to Stateside.
Hi, April. Thanks for having me.
Can we review some of the reasons that American consumers lost some of their interest in EVs over the past year or 2 years?
Yeah, I think a big one really is what we saw last fall. And there was a big change in the federal consumer purchase tax credit. And what that had really allowed was, you know, $7,500 that helped offset the higher price of an EV compared with a gasoline vehicle. And so that had really helped support a lot of purchases and leases of new EVs over the last couple of years. And as of September 30th, that credit went away. And what people were forecasting and what we saw happen was really just a fall in demand. And without that tax credit, all of a sudden that EV essentially became $7,500 more expensive. And so it was, I think, something that people were prepared for and expecting would happen. And when we talk to automakers now, a lot of them are saying, you know, it's going to take some time to see what natural demand ultimately settles out to be.
Right. So let me ask you this. What signs do you look to when you're trying to get a beat on EV sales?
You know, I think one of the key things to watch is right now has been around pricing and incentives and the products. You know, I think without that tax credit, we've kind of been watching to see what do automakers do with pricing. You know, do they have to lower the price? Are they putting more incentives on their vehicles, because, you know, trying to make that price closer to what consumers had experienced with the tax credit in place. And we're seeing some of that on kind of both sides as automakers try to figure out what it is. But we've also seen some of the models that are coming are smaller, a little bit more affordable. And so I think, you know, watching to see what's going to happen there, how all of that kind of shakes out, I think is going to be interesting to see.
Are you hearing, would you say, more concern from automakers about moving the vehicles that dealers have on the lot right now? Or maybe the larger question going forward of retooling what they're going to have coming off the line over the next 2 or 3 years?
I think when you talk to dealers, a lot of them will say, you know, we're going to need some kind of incentive support because these vehicles were moving and then the tax credit goes away and now we're having a harder time getting customers interested in them. You know, it's much bigger than just incentives. I mean, it's really a lot of dealers will talk about, you know, just kind of the need for education, right? Where do you charge? Can you charge at home? How does this vehicle work? How does it fit in your lifestyle? And so I think a lot of them are trying to figure out how to work with consumers to figure out if this indeed fits their lifestyle. Do they drive far distances or did they drive closer to home? Do they live in an apartment where they don't have a home charger or can they install one in the garage? But a lot of it too is just, you know, needing that kind of incentive support to help make that financially, you know, compatible for consumers who are in these internal combustion vehicles now and might need a little bit more of a push to switch. So that's one of the things we're seeing. Automakers are taking different approaches as far as production, you know, which models are available, how many are being built. I think trying to get a sense of how do we balance inventory with demand.
Tesla's always been a strong brand in the United States EV market, partly because of the strength of their charging system infrastructure. There was some global pushback to Elon Musk as a brand himself due to his involvement in politics some years ago, but it's looking like Tesla sales have jumped up a bit in the past month or two. Do you have a sense of what role Tesla plays in the EV market in terms of its new and used vehicles? I mean, do the domestic makers still see it as their top competition?
I mean, Tesla still leads the market, right? And that when that's the only type of powertrain that they build. And so they have had a very strong kind of command of the EV market here in the US for a long time. And I think when we've seen the automakers roll out their EVs, initially they were the one that they were trying to catch up with. And so I think, you know, that's one of the things I think that people are watching. But we have seen Tesla's share drop, I think partly as other automakers are bringing out their vehicles. There's, you know, some discussion of, you know, Tesla's vehicles haven't been updated as frequently as maybe some others. And so are other brands' EVs now maybe more technology, better styling? They're, you know, catching up on what Tesla is offering, even though they're still the leader out there. I think it's going to be interesting to see really what happens with everybody, not just the traditional automakers that have EVs plus internal combustion, but also the EV makers who solely are focused on EVs and where demand goes, because they don't have, you know, the high profit V8 pickups and SUVs to lean on. And so, you know, how this shift in demand in the market is going to affect companies like Tesla or Rivian is going to be interesting to see.
Lindsay, the past year or so has been such a game of whiplash. Tesla is up, and then, you know, Elon Musk becomes something out of an enfant terrible, and all of a sudden, some consumers aren't as interested in buying their cars. The Biden administration is pushing EVs, then the Trump administration, you know, cuts the subsidies. I've got to believe in the companies you cover that there's been immense amount of frustration at the lack of predictability.
You know, I think for any company, what they'll tell you is, you know, certainty is important, right? Because it helps you figure out what your product plan is going to look like, where to build certain vehicles, when to put them forward. All these kinds of changes make it very difficult to know how to plan for the long term. And I think that's what they're all trying to figure out. And whether it's tariffs or changes in EV regulations, you know, it makes these decisions difficult. I was in New York last week at the New York International Auto Show, and John Bozzella is the CEO of the Alliance for Automotive Innovation. It's a trade group that represents major automakers in the U.S. And at a panel discussion, he was talking really about what he called regulatory whiplash of the last few years. And it's this idea that, you know, when new administrations come in, policy changes from one end to the other. And he sort of talked about in the past, you know, regulations would change given what a certain administration was interested in doing. But, you know, generally he said they were still backed by what was, you know, technically feasible and what consumer demand was supporting. And he said, you know, we're starting to see after each election tearing up the whole playbook and starting over again. And so I think that it does make that challenging. And I think that's what the industry is hoping for, is more certainty and predictability. You know, this is what the playbook is going to be. We can now adapt our businesses to that.
I get a sense that one of the elephants in the room for those in the EV game is the cadre of Chinese makers that right now have a number of vehicle models that are priced well below domestic U.S. EVs, if they can ever get access free and clear to U.S. markets. I believe right now tariffs on Chinese vehicles are still pretty close to 100%, aren't they?
On the EVs, that's correct, yes. And yeah. It's interesting, when you were talking about Tesla, that was sort of what automakers were kind of looking to over the last few years as, you know, the company to kind of catch. And I think China now has a lot of the industry concerned about their products, their technology, their price points. You know, there's a lot of discussion about kind of this level playing field and how the Chinese industry has been able to grow and develop the way that it has. I mean, it has the potential that if they were to enter the U.S., that it could pretty significantly undercut what the U.S. industry is able to do. There's concern right now because, you know, they're interested in finding new markets. And, you know, there's recently an agreement with Canada to allow, I think, 49,000 Chinese electrified vehicles at a lower tariff rate. And some automakers will say in other markets that we compete in, they're already in the market as well. And so there's a discussion about, you know, how does the U.S. approach that? What policies are necessary to address this? I mean, the president has signaled that he'd said when he was in Detroit earlier this year that, you know, if they wanted to come in and build a plant, that he'd be open to it. I don't know what kind of form that might take or if and when that happens. I think there are certainly those that think it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I think right now the industry is focused on, you know, what are the policies that need to happen to ensure, you know, fair competition if and when that were to happen.
Lindsay Van Hulley is a deputy editor at Automotive News. Lindsay, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The stories we work on deal with a lot of current events, and we understand that's a large part of why you're here. But we know that you may also have questions about Michigan news that go a little bit deeper. For example, is there a reason why our automotive industry got so deeply invested in gas-powered engines? Whatever's been rattling around between your ears about the news, or really anything about this place where we live, we're glad to take on your questions in our podcast, On Hand. It's where we dig into all kinds of Michigan-specific stories. If you'd like to submit a question, just head over to Michigan Public's website. There's a really easy contact form at the On Hand page. We'd love to feature you in an upcoming episode. We're going to pause for just a moment now. After that, a surgical innovation using microscopic robots to make operations safer and easier in the recovery stage. That's next after the break. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Back in the 1960s, there was a science fiction movie called Fantastic Voyage.
You are listening to the sound of a completely new screen experience. A startling new kind of excitement. As 20th Century Fox plunges you into the most incredible adventure that man could ever achieve.
A submarine crew shrinks down to microscopic size and enters a scientist's bloodstream to save his life.
Four men and a beautiful girl, off on a fantastic voyage, actually entering inside the human body, exploring an unknown universe, unknown dangers.
They're tightening. I can't breathe.
24 seconds left.
Efforts by researchers at Michigan State University and Henry Ford Health have taken us just a step closer to something like that being a reality. I'm not talking about shrunken submarines and little tiny scientists, but a new technology of tiny magnetic robots. It's called TriMag technology. These objects can be detected and controlled by magnets, making procedures like cancer treatment and brain surgery less invasive and safer. The robots can specifically target tumor cells and use magnetic heating to kill them without affecting surrounding areas. We're not to the point yet where this technology is being used in humans, but it is a very exciting development in biomedical research right here in East Lansing. My guest today is Jinxing Li, a biomedical engineering professor who worked directly on developing this process. Professor Li, welcome to Stateside.
Yes, thank you, April. Happy to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the Trimag robots look like?
It do look like a helical corkscrew, or our smaller word, it look like a perhaps like a sperm cell. So basically, it can, you know, has a little tail which can respond to magnetic field and swim around.
And when we say that they're extremely small, how small are we talking here?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's pretty much smaller than the diameter of a human hair, or 10 times smaller than that. So in that way, we can really operate our single cell level, so can really give precision treatment.
Why did you decide to call them Trimag?
So basically, why we call it Trimag, okay. So it combines three magnetic functions. First, we can use magnetic field to drive them, to actuate them to move around. Secondly, is that we can use magnetic field to image them. We use a technology called magnetic particle imaging. We can really track them when they are moving inside the body. And thirdly, we can also use extremely high frequency magnetic field to kind of heat it up. So basically, the micro robot, we increase its own temperature from room temperature, for example, to 50 or 60 degrees when they are in the body, so that they can ablaze their cell. So basically, we integrate three magnetic functions in a single device. That's why we call it a Trimag micro robot.
I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this next question, but considering that we're talking about something so microscopically sized, can you tell us a little bit about how these robots are made? I mean, it's not as if you can work on them with a set of tweezers under a under a microscope. How are they constructed?
That's a great question. In terms of the size, first, we cannot see them by just naked eyes because they are so tiny, definitely smaller than their pencil tip. So we make this using an extremely high precision 3D printer. So it's called a two-photon lithography. Actually, the technology, this printer is, I believe, the first one, or perhaps only one, is in Michigan, and the first one installed in the States. It allow us to print extremely tiny structure, I believe, could be 1 million times than smaller than human hair. So basically, it uses light to fabricate 3D devices or fabricate it similar like we make the computer chips in a clean room environment. And we then, you know, observe them, control them under optical microscope. So all of these are done with, you know, really a cutting edge either imaging tool or fabrication tool.
Incredible. Can you describe the process of getting them into a test subject and once they're in, how they can be controlled?
So we currently do this on subject. For example, we can use this to deliver medicine to eye. Like, cause for some of the medicine, we need to, inject into, for example, the retina, which is the deeper in the eye. Conventionally people might use a very invasive needle to do that, but we can actually just, put this on just below the surface of the eye, and then we can remotely use a magnetic field to drive them. So for something that moving in the eye, we can actually use optic imaging to see them. We also use another technology in Michigan State called magnetic particle imaging, because these micro robots are magnetic, so we'll be able to see them by this technology, and we can drive them into deep eye. I think this is one example. Another example, we use this to kind of ablate tumor. So we graft the human breast tumor in our subject. Actually, it's not a human subject. And then we show that we can use this robot actually to remotely ablate the tumor, to shrink the tumor size, because we can actually use magnetic field to heat it up. It's like a microwave, but a localized microwave to heat something up so we can only kill the tumor cell without hurting the healthy cells.
Incredible. So what kinds of procedures did you have in mind when you were designing TriMag robots?
So there are a few things we are thinking about. First thing, as I just mentioned, we can use this to ablate tumor in a more precise way. We currently work with Henry Ford Hospital, actually neurosurgeon there. When they do this kind of brain tumor surgery, they have to use a very invasive process, open kind of school surgery. But through this microbots, we might be able to just, for example, drill a small hole and then use the micro robot to ablate the whole tumor without a big incision. I think that's one example. Another one is for clot removal for cardiovascular disease. For example, there's a small clot in the blood vessel. We can actually drive this micro robot to really spin around, collect all this small clot, so we can really treat this kind of life-threatening conditions.
So, I mean, it sounds like the interface itself is just really remarkable. The fact that with something like an eye, these things wouldn't even need to be injected. They could just be introduced to the eye. I understand that that might be different for different parts of the body. Can we assume that recovery times would also be faster?
Yeah, for sure. Because, first of all, this is meant to be minimally invasive or potentially non-invasive, meaning that we are not doing, for example, what's for surgery, we're not opening the chest or doing something like that. I think definitely we're leads to much faster recovery time. Yeah.
What are the limitations on this technology at this point? What are things about it that still need to be worked out before they could be tested for human health?
So there are a few things. I think primarily the challenge is imaging. I think seeing through the body, right? So because they're so tiny, we can see them nicely, get beautiful videos, control them under an optical microscope in our lab settings. But our body is a different setting. So how do we, you know, observe them through your muscle? I think that's a challenge. And luckily, we got some technology here, like as I mentioned, magnetic particle imaging. We might also combine this with CT imaging so that we can really see them precisely in the body. And another thing, of course, in terms of robotics is control. Like, how do we control one of them or potentially multiple robots to form like a swarm? I think there's another level of challenge we need to figure out. This needs to like a cross-disciplinary collaboration. I'm a biomedical engineer with electrical engineering background, but we need to work with, for example, imaging expert or control and robotics expert. Eventually, we want to develop an autonomous system that can really, like an autonomous car driving the body. I think that's kind of that's definitely a lot of work to do in this area.
Is there a system through which the TriMags have to be removed from the body after a surgery, after a procedure is finished?
That's a good question. There are two ways to deal with that issue. First one is they can degrade. So the current version we made, the TriMag, actually, they are made by biocompatible polymer or biodegradable polymer and also nanoparticles, which can degrade themselves or can be removed by our circulation system, which is pretty safe. Another way we can definitely try to kind of collect them back using magnets as well, because they're a magnetic robot. I think there are two ways to do that, but generally, definitely we have to make them safe. Yeah.
Would there come a point if they're left to degrade in the body at which white blood cells would attack them and the body's natural defense system would break them down?
You're right. So they will naturally break down to, I think there are two components. One is the nanoparticles. The another one is polymer. The polymer are very healthy, like basically is edible. So, and these nanoparticles, they can potentially be, you know, removed from, for example, as you said, immune cell or accumulates in the kidney, but it's all a matter of how much, right? When we think about toxicity, if they stay there. So the level we are using actually is very kind of healthy and compatible. And also we are using iron oxide nanoparticles. It's pretty much widely used in the medicine community because we need iron in our body. There's nothing toxic. Yeah.
Right. Are there some applications that you can imagine for TriMag beyond medicine? Other jobs, perhaps, that these devices could do?
I think I like this question the most because I think, of course, it's primarily used for medicine, but there are a few things which we can use them to do. For example, we can use them to, you know, do manufacturing, to do nanomanufacturing. Like, so basically think about like large robots, we can use them to, you know, manufacture large scale, you know, objects or products. But for these micro robots, actually we can, if we get intelligent enough, we can actually use them like a micro scale kind of factory to make, for example, electronic circuits or micro devices. I think that's one thing we can do. And we can also use them, control them to do micro nanoscale inspection of a lot of electronic circuits and devices. So I think there are a lot of engineering applications of these micro robots.
How many years have you been working on developing TriMag robots?
So I worked in this micro nanorobotics areas. I've been working on this area for 17 years, I think, from 2009, right after I got my bachelor degree. And for this specific project, we actually started around 3 years ago after I started my lab at Michigan State. We were outsourcing the fabrication, but luckily from last year, we got this state-of-the-art equipment installed in Michigan State, which dramatically accelerate what we can do. Yeah, now we're developing a lot of new version of this micro robot.
What would you say has been the most challenging stage of getting the technology to this point, with the understanding again that there's still work to do?
I think the most challenging is fabrication, manufacturing. Of course, Michigan is a state of manufacturing, but this is another level of manufacturing, or different level. So when we think about any devices or robotics, I think the first challenge, of course, is how to power them. I think this can be solved by magnetic field. But then the second thing is how do you get like scalable, reproducible precision manufacturing. I think this is a key to enable any technology to be commercialized. So I think we spend a lot of time to really get this equipment, but also how to use the equipment in the way what we want, to how these different materials, geometry integrated together on our single devices. I think that's kind of the challenge. And I think by only solving that, we can really push this forward, especially we are not working on like virtual like AI area, right? So we are working on really the tangible physical domain, try to make devices that can work. So I think really manufacturing is the key.
My guest today has been Professor Jinxing Li of Michigan State University's Department of Biomedical Engineering. Professor Li, thank you so much for speaking with us. We really appreciate it.
Yes, thank you, April.
What's on your mind these days? We do love hearing from you, especially if there's a story or question we might be able to tackle. Anything specific to elections that you're curious about? What's the Michigan road trip you're most looking forward to taking this year? You can drop an email. The address is stateside@michiganpublic.org. Or maybe you'd rather leave a message on social media for us. We'll see it if you post on the Michigan Public Facebook page, or you can also DM us on Instagram or TikTok. Our handles on both of those platforms are at Michigan Public. It's time for a short break. After that, how the UP became part of Michigan.
And he's in a tavern, and the deputy comes in. Well, one Stickney's brother, two, stands up to defend him, and they get into a physical altercation in which two Stickney stabs the deputy with a penknife.
That's such a wild story. It's just a lawless place, you know? It feels so wild.
It absolutely is, yeah.
So far as anybody knows, this is the only actual blood drawn in the Toledo War, which really makes the term war seem like an exaggeration. But they're fighting over boundaries, and Toledo is there, so that's the name. It's kind of funny if you're thinking about it now. Not so much if you're the deputy. He was pretty sure his stab wound was fatal.
He was taken to a local doctor in what is, again, today Toledo, who pronounced that, you know, he was fine, but he didn't trust this guy because he was known to be pro-Ohio.
That's up next. You're listening to Stateside. You're listening to On Hand, a production of Stateside.
Hi, I'm Jens Kretschmer from Saline, Michigan. I grew up in Germany, and I'm here since 2005. One question I have is, why do we have two peninsulas? Where does that come from?
Michigan really is one of the wonkiest looking states. I mean, what other state can you think of that has a bonus attachment that sits so far north it actually bumps into Canada, and so far west it stretches into another time zone? How did it come to be ours? Why doesn't the UP belong to Canada or Wisconsin? Today, we're turning to our friends at Interlochen Public Radio to answer Jens' question. They've got the goods on the origin story of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And as it turns out, the story of the peninsula up north actually begins down south in Ohio. It involves a rivalry even fiercer than our storied football standoff between OSU and the U of M. And it's shaped the state that we know and inhabit today. Points North producer Ryan Schnur has the story for us.
It's the early 1800s. And the Great Lakes region doesn't have many U.S. states. It's mostly part of one big territory, the Northwest Territory. Then, one day, politicians get together and decide to create the state of Ohio. And they do all the things you need for statehood, drafting a constitution, drawing state lines, and they're getting ready to send it to Congress. But then, the story goes, a fur trapper wanders out of the woods.
I've heard the story, seen the story in writing, never seen any real documentation. It's a great story, maybe just a myth.
That's Ted Long, a local historian and storyteller in Toledo, Ohio.
I mean, I can just imagine this grizzled trapper with a big burly beard coming in to the offices of the state legislature and saying, "Hold on, gentlemen, you know, you're about to make a major mistake."
Okay, so bear with me. We're going to talk about geography, because this whole story really boils down to a single line on a map, part of the northern boundary of Ohio. The Ohio politicians had borrowed their border from an old regional map. It seemed as good a line as any. But the trapper says their map is wrong.
Whipping out some kind of crude map and showing them how if you follow through with what you're going to use, you're going to lose Maumee Bay and parts of the shore of Lake Erie.
There was a port on the west end of Lake Erie, right by the Maumee River, and it was one of the most important trade routes in the region. Back then, water was the quickest way to transport things. People would load up boats full of furs and other goods, whiskey, flour, guns, and ship them up and down the Maumee. They could get to Detroit in Canada. They could also make it all the way down the Mississippi to the ocean. Basically, it was a transcontinental railroad for boats. And so the trapper says, if you put the line where you're thinking of putting it, you're going to give up control over this whole trade route.
And then I could just see the look on the faces of these legislators, you know, just now what? And then there's always, you know, that there's that one person in the room who just says, well, let's just slide it up to the north a little bit. And no one will ever notice.
So that's what they did. They shifted the border to the north and claimed the port for Ohio. And that's the line that became their official state border. But there's a problem. Another territory had formed to the north a couple years later, Michigan. And the federal government gave them the old line, the one Ohio almost used before the trappers stopped them. That old line gave Michigan control of the port and the major trade route. So Michigan and Ohio each surveyed their versions of the border, and we end up with two competing lines running at slightly different angles. They create a sort of wedge-shaped strip of land with the port at one end, and nobody can agree about who owns it.
They were inside what was called the area of dispute.
The area of dispute. I love that term. It seems to perfectly capture the confusion of the moment. Everybody is just marking boundaries and staking claims. It's a land rush. The world is up for grabs. Of course, the U.S. had just recently taken this land from the indigenous people living there, the Erie, Kickapoo, Odawa, and Seneca. So really, neither Michigan nor Ohio had any sort of grand claim to the area. But the white settlers who live in this area of dispute, they can't agree if they're part of Ohio or Michigan. And the guy in charge of the port writes to the governor of Ohio and says,
"You have a problem, and this is just going to get bigger and bigger."
He was right. The problem did get worse. And 20 years later, it erupted into a war. Sort of. People call it a war, at least. The Toledo War. It's the 1830s, and the governor of the Michigan Territory is named Stevens T. Mason, the boy governor. They called him the boy governor because he was really young, in his early 20s, and pretty aggressive.
Stevens T. Mason is very keen on A, building a reputation for himself, but also he sees a lot of potential in Michigan.
Marty Hershock is a professor of history at the University of Michigan, Dearborn.
He really starts to push for statehood and for Michigan to include within its geographic boundaries the mouth of the Maumee.
In other words, he wants the area of dispute, the port, and the trade route. Michigan's major aggression starts with an act, the Pains and Penalties Act.
Just the name, Pains and Penalties Act, in itself, makes it sound just very, very obscure but and scary.
Ted Long again.
It's an act that says, if you even think of insulting the state of or the territory of Michigan, we're going to come down, arrest you, and put you in jail.
Yeah, you don't call something the Pains and Penalties Act unless you're trying to project an image of aggression.
Exactly. Exactly.
The big thing this act says, though, the thing that really ramps up the aggression, is that Michigan could arrest Ohioans for acting like they owned the area of dispute. And they do. Michigan sheriffs arrest Ohioans that summer for voting, surveying, agitating. Obviously, Ohio was mad about this, so its governor gathers his own troops at the edge of the area of dispute.
That's when it really starts to look like something serious is going to happen. These are mobs of people that are really upset and trying to have a physical part in deciding who's going to get this property.
You've got committed governors, angry villagers, troops amassed along the borders, the prime conditions for full-out war. But nothing major really ends up happening. And when blood is eventually drawn, it's so minor it's almost comical. That story begins with a guy named Benjamin Franklin Stickney.
He's quite a character. I mean, one of my favorite Toledo characters.
Stickney had just helped found the city of Toledo in the area of dispute. And he has two sons. Their names are 1 and 2 Stickney.
He didn't think it was fair for parents to name their children and force them to live with those names throughout their entire life. So he gave his children temporary names so that they could later on decide to change their name.
Except they didn't. They stuck with 1 and 2. At this point, the Stickneys are all in for Ohio. One Stickney has been organizing people in the area of dispute, so Michigan sends a sheriff's deputy down to arrest him.
And he's in a tavern, and the deputy comes in. Well, one Stickney's brother, 2, stands up to defend him, and they get into a physical altercation in which 2 Stickney stabs the deputy with a penknife.
That's such a wild story. It's just a lawless place, you know? It feels
It
so wild.
Absolutely is, yeah.
So far as anybody knows, this is the only actual blood drawn in the Toledo War, which really makes the term war seem like an exaggeration. But they're fighting over boundaries, and Toledo is there, so that's the name. It's kind of funny if you're thinking about it now. Not so much if you're the deputy. He was pretty sure his stab wound was fatal.
He was taken to a local doctor in what is, again, today Toledo, who pronounced that, you know, he was fine, but he didn't trust this guy because he was known to be pro-Ohio.
So he called in a surgeon from Michigan who confirmed,
"You're going to live."
Now, remember, Michigan is still a territory, but it desperately wants statehood. And they want to make sure their border includes that area of dispute and the major trade port. So the boy governor decides he's just going to keep acting like he owns the place. Keep sending militias, keep arresting people. But Ohio is a pretty powerful enemy, and it's fighting back. It's already a state, which means it has more independence and credibility than Michigan. So the Ohio politicians pull a legal move. They decide to create a new county in the area of dispute, surrounding the city of Toledo, to make it harder for Michigan to convince the feds it owns the place. But creating that county, it's kind of risky.
They realize in order for that all to be legal, they have to hold court inside that property.
And they have to do it without getting arrested by Michigan. So the governor of Ohio sends staff to Toledo to hold court, to make the county. And Michigan sends 1,000 armed men on horseback to stop them. The Ohio guys have to outfox the Michiganders, so on the day of the hearing, they find a spot right on the very edge of town, a schoolhouse.
And they hold the court at basically, I think, 4 or 5 in the morning. I could see all these Michigan troops, they're riding up and down the streets trying to figure out where this court's being held. And they've been completely duped because they're there at the wrong time, number one and number two.
They were in the wrong place. An Ohio judge, a clerk, and the rest of the court staff meet in the schoolhouse with the desks and the chalk. It's a quick process, about 10 minutes total. They certify the records, and the race is on. They need to book it out of town and get these court records back to undisputed Ohio territory.
The paperwork that had to be signed to make it all legal gets stuffed into someone's hat, and they all take off in different directions so they're not caught by anybody or trailed by anyone.
The guy who actually has the court papers is the clerk, Dr. Horatio Conant. He's got them tucked up into his hat, and he's riding along toward the Ohio border, no Michigan militia in sight. Then his hat gets knocked off by a tree branch. Now the official records are on the forest floor somewhere.
You know, he has to turn around and go back and get it.
So he's searching for these papers in the dark, and he's got to find them because otherwise the whole thing doesn't count.
It adds another element to this whole story that makes it sound like, you know, it certainly ought to be a movie.
So the clerk is looking and looking until eventually he finds the papers, and he gathers them up and keeps riding toward Ohio. And he makes it. Ohio now has an official county in the area of dispute, and it will be that much harder for Michigan to make its case for control. That isn't the end, though. Sure, Ohio had this county, but Michigan isn't backing down. So eventually, President Andrew Jackson and the U.S. Congress have had enough. Like parents trying to break up a couple of bickering toddlers, they step in to resolve this thing with the area of dispute, now often called the Toledo Strip. They make Michigan an offer.
"We will allow you to become a state, but in return, you must give up your claim to the Toledo Strip."
And they offer, as a consolation prize, the western part of the Upper Peninsula. Michigan already has the eastern part of the UP, from back when it became a territory. And nobody in Michigan wants more UP. They don't think it has any real value.
It was considered to be a howling wilderness.
So Michigan turns down the offer from Congress. But the boy governor isn't done. He really wants to take the deal. He wants the Toledo Strip, but he wants statehood more. And he also knows he's got an uphill battle, because people in Michigan really, really want that area of dispute. But he's got one more trick up his sleeve, a political maneuver. He spends the next few months riding around the territory, getting a bunch of new cronies elected, people on his side of the debate. And then he organizes a convention in December of 1836.
It happens during a very cold spate of weather. There's only one sort of stove that heats the interior. So there's not a lot of heat. And if you're not near the stove, you're getting virtually none of it.
They're uncomfortable. They're feeling a lot of pressure to get this done.
And so they kind of swallow the bitter pill and they endorse the compromise.
They call it the Frostbitten Convention, partly because it's so cold, and partly because they know it will get a frosty reception from the people of Michigan, who still don't approve of the deal.
In fact, the resolution that they adopt includes the following language. It is better to be humiliated and to secure the civil and religious liberties inherent in statehood than to engage in an idle, unprofitable, and hopeless contest for a boundary which is assuredly and forever lost to us.
So, wow.
Not a ringing endorsement.
So Ohio gets the port and the area of dispute. Michigan gets statehood and the rest of the UP.
I mean, this is sort of the question that is begged by any time the term war gets associated with something. Who won in your mind?
Well, I think at the time, Michigan clearly felt like they lost.
Ted Long, the Ohioan.
Over time, you know, Upper Peninsula proved to be a very big economic boom for the state of Michigan with the copper mines and later on all the tourism that goes on there. So, you know, it's time only is the kind of factor in the question of who won.
I asked the same thing of Marty Hershaw, who is, of course, from Michigan.
Toledo is pleasant. It has a nice zoo. It's got a nice art museum. I don't mind spending time in Toledo. I've got a lot of friends from Toledo, but in comparison to the Upper Peninsula, I think that Michigan fared much, much better.
There's a great irony, I think, here in that this western part of the UP feels like it ultimately became arguably one of the most important parts of the whole thing.
Yeah, right. It added tremendous wealth and character to the state of Michigan.
It reminded me of the shirts from the beginning of the episode, the ones people wear around the time of the Michigan-Ohio State football games that say Toledo War Champs with the outline of the UP.
I think it's funny. It's good for them to have that piece of pride.
Zach Bernath, the Ohio State fan from the intro. He's also a friend of mine.
Ohio State fans probably won't wear the same shirt with a little sliver of lamb by Toledo. It doesn't carry the same weight.
Wars, like sports, are built around the concept of winners and losers. Games, battles, trophies, land. But I actually don't think that's the most important thing about this particular story. This whole thing, the port, the UP, the boy governor, the frostbitten convention. It's a reminder that the states as we know them weren't always fixed entities, even if it's hard to imagine things shaking out any other way. And over the centuries, these contested areas have come to mean a lot in terms of state identity and pride. So when Michigan and Ohio State take the field this November, I'll be thinking about the Toledo Strip. And this moment, 200 years back, when the course of history shifted with a line on a map.
That was an episode of the Points North podcast titled Pushing the Boundary. I cannot recommend Points North enough. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. That episode was produced by Ryan Schnurr, with editing from Morgan Springer, Dan Wanshura, Ellie Katz, and Claire Keenan-Kurgan. That's it for Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.